You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we're kicking off a WPR news series that takes a look at the ins and outs of the Affordable Care Act.
Before that, we return to the issue of college debt. As we hear more and more these days, students are graduating with record amounts of debt, and in turn, a lot of them are defaulting on those loans.
One possible solution to ease the debt burden could be income-based repayment plans. The idea was recently discussed at a forum at UW-Madison.
Joining us now is Nick Hillman. He's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, a faculty affiliate with WISCAPE. He also spoke at that forum we just mentioned. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So before we get into how this specific plan works, remind us, how big a problem is debt for students?
Well, we can take that problem and slice it in a few different directions. For some students, it's not a problem whatsoever. Many students, actually the majority of students, borrow less than $20,000 in student loan debt, which, yeah, is a whole lot of money. But they're finding ways to manage those payments, especially on a 10-year repayment schedule. There are, however, several students in these cut along lines of social class, race, ethnicity, where this debt issue becomes a real significant problem, not just in terms of the volume of student loan debt, but the sheer percentage of students who are relying on this as a way to finance their education.
So at this forum we mentioned, you were talking about income-based repayment plans. What are those?
Well, they are what some people would call an innovative solution to student financial aid. And in my research, I'm finding it's not all that innovative. It's really an old idea that's, I think, in search of a new problem. It was proposed in the 1950s on a variation of the theme where employers would basically fund individuals' college education in exchange for a share of those individuals' future earnings. And Milton Friedman was the proponent behind this, and in 1955 came out with an article kind of setting up the idea of this human capital contract, which eventually later evolved into what is now known as the income-based repayment plan. And so what's ironic about this is that the first federal student loan, as we know it today, wasn't made until the 60s, and really the loan program that we know today really blew up in the 1970s and became a much larger part of the higher education landscape in the 70s. Yet this solution to the student financing problem has been around since the 50s. So it's a not always one-to-one problem and solution there.
So how would this work? Take a student who is in that latter category that you mentioned and is in trouble, may never be able to pay off debt, may default. How would that work over the course of their debt repayment career?
Right. That's the question. So currently, depending on how you look at default, about 15% of students default on their federal student loans within just 3 years of entering repayment. You think about that. It's a large number of people just in a few years of repayment. If you extend that out to the lifetime of their loan, then about 20, in some cases even higher than that, percent are defaulting on their debts. And so this income-based repayment plan would say, okay, if you qualify, then the federal government would take a certain percentage of your earnings every month and have that be applied to your student loan debt. And in theory, that would help you manage your payments and help you anticipate and sort of insure against unforeseen circumstances like unemployment or other financial hardship, so that if a borrower does get in a pinch, then they know that their repayment will never break the bank too badly. At least in theory, that's how it works.
But are they paying any more or less than they would have if they had to fill out the little whatever they do nowadays? It's probably not those little slips of paper that I had.
No. The principle, though, is the same. And yes, they can pay a lot more depending on their circumstances by extending the lifetime of their loan even further. Congressman Petri was on the panel with us, and he proposed to have some limits on how much interest was repaid on these plans. So that's one tweak to the existing system that we see some policymakers offering. President Obama is proposing to have all borrowers participate in these repayment plans, but we don't really know the net financial impact on students if it's a better deal than the current programs.
So what if the student loses their job? They don't have an income to take 15% out of, or they don't get a job right out of college in the first place.
Right. In those cases, there is some income sensitivity where if you fall below 150% of the poverty level, you won't make a payment. And in some of the work that I'm doing with my colleague Jacob Gross down at University of Louisville, we're trying to put this equity argument front and center in the evaluation of these programs. So they're tend to be the dominant argument about cost efficiencies. This is just a cheaper way to run our student aid system, and it probably is, and is an effective way to prevent default. Well, it probably is too, but is it an equitable way to finance education on the back of individuals, especially those who are in financial need? And in some ways, as long as we're protecting the ones who fall under that income threshold, then maybe there's some equity built into this model. But in bigger ways, I'm skeptical.
Yeah, and are you also rolling up more interest or even penalties while you're unemployed and not able to pay that 15% or whatever the percentage might be?
It depends, yeah, because it depends only because there are several different programs that the federal government offers in terms of how to repay your loans. There's an income-based repayment plan, there's an income contingent repayment plan, and then there's even another one called pay-as-you-earn and yet another income-sensitive repayment plan. So depending on which plan you're in is going to determine the answer to that question. In some cases, the federal government will cover you for a few years, but only three. In other cases, they won't.
I've seen some mention of forgiveness of the loan after a certain amount of time. Is that a built-in part of these repayment plans or no?
Yes and no. It's a built-in part to some. This is a great example of federal policy, federal financial aid policy becoming even more complicated than it necessarily needs to be.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, it sounds like we've got this complicated system and you've got these complicated wrinkles being thrown into the mix. And when does it get good for the borrower? I'm still not sure I'm convinced of that.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to figure out is what if, as President Obama is proposing now, that all borrowers are in this pay-as-you-earn program where their monthly earnings are tied to their monthly payments. Well, what kind of impacts will that have? Will that change individuals' borrowing behaviors on the front end when a student knows, hey, I can now major in social work because I know that only 8% of my earnings will be going towards my student loans in the future, as opposed to maybe some of them feeling pressure to take mm-hmm. a business degree and just get out there and get a job regardless of their financial circumstances.
Oh, that's been one of the criticisms of the mountains of student loan debt is that it pressures you away from maybe lower paying but fulfilling or world helping kind of job and into the thing where you can make the most money the fastest to pay off the loan the fastest.
Precisely. And when President Clinton introduced the first income contingent loan program in the early 1990s, that was the main logic behind it, where they were encouraging this loan forgiveness for public service jobs where they were able to encourage students to participate in public sector work. And we don't really have any evidence that that has actually played out.
We've got a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking my call. I want to say this is one of the best ideas I've ever heard, simply because I had a lot of friends who went to college and they were told by their professors, oh, do what you're passionate about, find what's interesting. And in a lot of ways, they took majors and put themselves in careers that were never going to provide a steady income or any type of life support in that manner financially. As such, this way it puts the college onus on the colleges to really turn out people who are able to earn a living and not just tell people, oh, do this because, you know, you like it. Well, if you're only doing what you like, that's a hobby.
Gotcha.
A job is something where you get paid.
Gotcha. Charlie, thanks. I want to get a response. Nick, will that be the case? Would that put more onus on the colleges?
Boy, I think it actually puts more onus on the individual students. And in this case, it actually might let states off the hook and let them continue to divest in state higher education. That's why tuition costs so much. That's why we have a lot of the affordability problems that we have today, is because states are retrenching. Individuals are carrying more of that burden. And if we sort of we create this as the default option for all borrowers, then I'm concerned that it just puts us on a slippery slope to even more privatization, individualization of our educational finances.
You mentioned that you're skeptical about this as, at least in the big picture, a solution for a lot of the student debt woes. Is there another avenue that you think we should be pursuing that would be more productive?
There are a few, yeah. And one of them, one of the big ones, first of all, is that the majority of student loan defaults, at least a significant portion of them, are occurring in the for-profit sector, the proprietary sector of higher education. And the federal government is supporting this. Billions and billions of dollars every year poured into the for-profit companies that are running these colleges. Yet these institutions, these companies, are the source of the default problem. So one solution would be to stop subsidizing the corporate higher education sector. If they are markets that should be able to work, then they don't need the federal government to be involved. That's one. The other is to continue to invest in aid programs that work. There's evidence that the aid and the support that comes around grant and scholarship aid can help students a lot. And so what we've seen is a divestment in the aid programs, purchasing power of aid programs slipping. And so if we reinvest there, that could be another way to be productive and proactive here.
Hypothetical, if you're sending a kid to college, do you say, hey, do this income-based repayment plan?
You know, for some students, it might really work well. And for some, if they can figure out how to apply and how to stay active in the repayment plan, then it might work well. But I think students should at least know it's an option. They also have other options where there are emergency protections if you're unemployed or if you do face health medical costs that are burdensome. You can get some forgiveness on your loans and know about these public sector loan forgiveness programs that are outside of these income-based models. So there are a lot of options. There may be too many options, but at least if people know about them, know what questions to ask, that'll help.
And probably looking ahead, the student loan system isn't going to get much less complicated in the years to come, is it?
I'm optimistic.
Oh, really?
I'm optimistic only because I have to be.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll leave it there. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Nick Hillman. He's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison.